Okay, now let's go to our next speaker, Steve Oss. He's the Associate Director of the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, and he does research and analysis for the Washington State Legislature. He's an economist. He has 25 years of experience working on conducting cost-benefit analysis in a wide range of public policy areas as well as in the private sector. His current work focuses on identifying and evaluating the costs and the benefits of programs and policies for reducing crime in Washington State. He's also been involved in evaluating Washington's foster care system and has many years of experience in energy and telecommunications policy. He's also run his own consulting firm. He's spoken to legislatures in 5 states across the country and at 5 recent meetings of the National Conference of State Legislators. And the work that he's doing is really quite unique. To my knowledge, there are only 2 people in the country right now who are doing cost-benefit analysis of corrections policies. And one of the papers that he'll be presenting to you today has been downloaded from the web 35,000 times. And you have a brief summary of this in your briefing report and the link to the full 150-page report that's on the web. From reading his work and interacting with him, it's obvious to me Mr. Oss has a very quick mind. But I've also learned through my investigation of our speakers that he's pretty quick on the tennis court, too. He made it to the championship match in his last tennis tournament, and he's ranked by the United States Tennis Association. So, Mr. Oss, it's time for you to take center court here at the Family Impact Seminar. His talk today is Using Taxpayer Dollars Wisely, Costs and Benefits of Incarceration and Other Crime Control Policies.
Thanks very much for having us here, the Washington members of the Washington Legislature, my bosses. Also say thank you for asking us to come and talk to you today. We were having trouble with the PowerPoints here, and I was starting to fill out a report that I have to fill out to Bill Gates himself whenever a state has trouble doing PowerPoint. I was able to not do that here at the end. I work for an Institute for Public Policy that's a creature of our legislature. It does nonpartisan work. We're not a committee staff, but we're also not at a university where all the assignments that we get are nonpartisan, and they come to us from our legislature. So we have a board of directors, House and Senate members equally divided among the parties, and also executive agency members. So the work I'll be talking about today is in the area of corrections agencies, the kinds of questions that our legislature has wanted answers to, and some of the work that we've done in that regard. The title of this seminar, that Can States Cut Costs and Curb Crime, is a two-part thing there. One, we'll talk about, do states affect the crime rate? Do what you do and what the Washington legislature does by incarcerating people or running programs, do they affect the crime rate at all? And the answer to that question is yes, what you do affects the crime rate in your state. And then the second part of that question would be, can you cut costs and still curb the crime rate, or at least not keep it from rising? And the answer to that question is also yes, I believe, and we'll show some evidence here and later in the day about why you can do that. But in order to do that, you can say, well, that's great, how can we do that? In order to do that, there's a one-word phrase that I'm going to use that will be an indication of how you can do it. The word is Starbucks. You have to, cut costs and curb crime, we've got to start thinking about the criminal justice system the way we would if we ran Starbucks, a company from my home state. Not the way we do it when we think about the criminal justice system as we normally run it. And what Starbucks does when they do that, their interest is their stockholders and getting the best rate of return that they can for their stockholders. And so they dispassionately go through the notion of how many stores to build, what to sell in the stores, what to do when they bring in the evidence, and that's where they invest the stockholders' dollars for their returns. And I think if we take that same approach to the correction side, we say, what's the evidence that something works or doesn't work? What kind of return do we get for our taxpayers? If we do that dispassionately, we'll find out that, at least in my state, perhaps your state, our system is not optimally configured right now, which means that by shifting the portfolio, you can actually cut the crime rate and keep costs from increasing, and in fact, decrease costs, as we have started to do in our own state. So, I'm going to do this little clicker. The two, if you're interested, on our webpage there, you can get these two reports. One's this big one, 35,000 downloads, all that stuff. You can get it there. All the information I'll talk about today are contained in those two reports. If anything I say is of interest to you, it's there. You can also contact me anytime you'd like. So what we're going to talk about today is this. We'll review some basic facts about incarceration rates, criminal justice costs, crime rates, and that will lead us to a discussion of Prison Economics 101 and 102. It might normally take two semesters. We're going to do it in about 2 minutes. And then that will lead us to some discussion about sentencing policy options and other kinds of programs that you all might want to consider to achieve that first objective. So let's begin by looking at those facts. We're just going to breeze through them here. I'm going to use Washington State data because that's who I work for. I have a feeling your data are not that different. And all these data are commonly available. You can have your staff, or if you are staff, you can assemble this information. Here's Washington State's adult prison incarceration rate, the number of people per 1,000 Washingtonians that are incarcerated. And I've got all the way back to 1925. Does this work? Let's see.
You've done pretty well in Washington State.
Yeah. It depends on your point of view, Ed. It depends on your point of view. From 1925 up through 2002, and this is how many Washingtonians we have incarcerated on an average day. Give me 1,000 Washingtonians back in 1940, how many were incarcerated, and then we'll look at what's happened since. And here come the numbers. So back in from about 1925 to about 1980 or so, we had somewhere between 2 and 3 Washingtonians out of 1,000 incarcerated. It went up in the 1930s during the lawless 30s in the Wild West out there. We started to do more crime and imprison more people. Went down. And then beginning in 1980 or so, it went up significantly. You'll see a little dip there in the late 1980s. That's right when we put our Sentencing Reform Act into the population actually went down, and then it's gone up significantly after that, about doubled the rate of incarceration. The national rate of growth in incarceration has been twice what it's been in Washington State. Let's take a look quickly at the type of offenders that are in Washington. I have these data reliably back from 1980 to 2002. Again, incarceration rates. We've increased the rate of violent offenders that are behind bars at any one point in time. Property offenders went up, went down, is about where it was back in 1980. And then drug offenders is the big thing that we added in Washington beginning in the late 80s and into the 90s and then flattening out. But we have a lot more now, about 20% of the people behind bars in state bars, adults, are drug offenders. So that's the new kid on the block, if you will, over that time period. Now let's take a look. I'm just going to get our basic facts here. Now the cost. So we have to pay for all this system. What I've done is I've added up all the criminal justice system costs from 19 that we spend at the local level for police. Let's see how this works. For police, for courts, prosecutors, criminal courts and criminal prosecutors, local sanctions, which would be jails and the local juvenile justice system in our state, as well as the state system for both state adults and juvenile things. And we got it back from 1975 to 2000. Ed, we don't spend any money on it, as you can see here. And this is expressed in real dollars per household. So it's sort of like your property tax. How much do we take from a household? Bill Gates' household and my household are all in there. And here's the numbers there. What we've done is we've increased significantly. We used to spend, in today's dollars, about $500 a household back in 1975. Today, that same household is asked to spend about $1,000 a household per year to fund all that stuff that we're doing, mostly because we're incarcerating more people and because we have more police on the streets. Those are the two main cost drivers. So that's the cost side of what we've done in the big picture in Washington. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is crime rates are down, as you've probably seen in this state. We're going to take a look from 1980 to 2001, referencing 1980, and then we'll take a look at the percent change in first property crime. We find out that property crime rates today in Washington are about 28% lower than they were back in 1980. Good news. violent crime rates took a different path to get there, but we're about 22% lower today than we were in 1980. So we're spending more money on the crime system, on the criminal justice system, but we're also getting less crime. And so the question naturally is, we've got the information now, now we're going to do economics 101, prison economics 101 here, because the logical question is, well, have we been getting any of that return on our spending, especially for prison system? So, does prison affect the crime rate? The answer is going to be yes. And here we go. We're going to plot those same crime rates that we just saw on a previous slide here. I put them together in this one. So it's the number of crimes per 1,000 Washingtonians running from 40 to 80. And then we're also down here, we're going to put the Washington's incarceration rate, the same incarceration rate that we saw a few minutes ago. How many people do we have on a given day behind bars in Washington? Now, people that think that prison doesn't work or works almost not at all are basically assuming that that line is flat, that no matter how the legislature or the judicial branch changes the incarceration rate, there's no effect or very little effect on the crime rate. Those are the flatliners. Prison doesn't work. It's a flat line. You can't affect the crime rate by adjusting your incarceration rate. The people that think that prison really works think that line is very steep, that if you even adjust the incarceration a little bit, you'll get a big change over here in your crime rate. What we find is that truth is somewhere in between those two positions, and let's take a look at the evidence for Washington State. Here's where we were in 1980. Each data point on this slide is going to be a point back there. In 1980, we had about two or so people per 1,000 incarcerated, you might remember, and we had a crime rate of about 68 or 69 per 1,000 of serious felony type of crimes. From 1980 to 1984, we began to increase the incarceration rate, and crime rates began to go down. Then, for a few years, you might remember that blip on that slide, we began to decrease the incarceration rate, fell back from about 3 to about 2, and crime rates began to go back up. And since that time, we've been increasing the incarceration rate, and crime rates have gone down. Now, we've done a big econometric analysis of this data. We've adjusted for the economic cycles, for demographic cycles, for other criminal justice variables, different kinds of things in there, the uniqueness of each county and the uniqueness of each year that we measure. And we find that this is the relationship that holds about that. And what that is about a 10% increase in incarceration leads somewhere to a 2 to 4% decrease in the crime rate, and that would work in reverse as well. If you decrease the incarceration rate, you're going to get more crime in your state. Now that's similar. That's what we did for Washington State. There have been some studies using national data that have found out the exact same ratio there in terms of that fundamental relationship. So now that's an interesting thing, but now let's take a look at the second semester here, Prison Economics 102. This is going to be the hardest thing we have to do, at least with me. Maybe Ed's got some tougher stuff this morning. This is the law of diminishing returns. The question is, we want to think like Starbucks here. In Olympia, the state capital, my hometown, we have 14 Starbucks stores. We used to have no Starbucks stores. When Starbucks put the first store in, that store made them a lot of money. The 14th store, I can guarantee you, doesn't make them as much money as when they put that first store in. They get diminishing returns as they begin to saturate a market. That's why there aren't 100 Starbucks stores in Olympia. There are 14 because Starbucks, being a rational business-making enterprise looking out after its stockholders' interests, has figured out it can make money with 14 stores, but it can't make money with the 50th store or the 100th store. So, and the same economics that apply to Starbucks, I'll posit, apply to the prison business. As we've increased that incarceration rate, you get more and more of the serious offenders already in prison, and fewer of them are out there. And so you start, each additional bed you build solves fewer and fewer crimes. And that's what our research shows, is that back in 1980, when we first began increasing the incarceration rate, as we built those additional beds, we got somewhere between 40 and 60 crimes solved per year by doing that. But diminishing returns works for the prison just as it does for Starbucks. And today, now that we've got incarceration rates much higher, we get much less bang for the buck. We still get a bang. We still get to reduce some crimes because these are not angels that are going into prison. But if you increase the incarceration rate to include 50% of the population, that 50, let's say I'm the 50th person, you know, out of 100 that you put in prison, the crime rate's not going to go down because I don't do crime, you know. Well, once, you know. Sometimes I walk my dog without the leash. Okay, but so at some point you do run out of criminals. You've got more of them behind bars and less of them on the street, and the point is that curve drops down, and this, of course, affects the economics of imprisonment. Now, what we've been able to do, let's just recap this one. Incarceration rates are up, costs are up, crime rates down. We think, without doubt, that what you set in terms of prison policy does affect the crime rate, but that the law of diminishing returns is set in as all the states have increased that crime rate significantly. So what was true economically for increase in prison back in the 1980s may not be true today. So what we've done is a cost-benefit analysis of prison and all the other alternatives to prison, from early prevention programs for youngsters through juvenile justice systems, through the adult system, all the kinds of rehabilitation programs, anything that has reasonable research that's rigorous about, we've analyzed that. And we said, what works? What's evidence-based? Just like Starbucks, I don't want some pie-in-the-sky thing. I want to know something that's been rigorously evaluated to work or not work. We were interested in things that don't work, too, because if we're doing those, we want to not do more of those things. What works, the best evidence to work crime? We've already talked about prison here. We think it lowers crime. What else does? And then we said, what makes sense economically? So we said, if prison treatment or prevention, if anything reduces crime, if we can have evidence that they reduce crime, then there are going to be two beneficiaries that we measure, to victims and taxpayers. There'll be fewer crimes, so there'll be fewer crime victims. That's terrific. And there'll be fewer taxpayers, and there'll be fewer taxpayer costs, and that's another good thing. But these prisons cost money, and programs, drug programs cost money, so it sets up that fundamental tension that we economists just love, you know, benefit cost, rate of return kind of thing. So what we'll be able to talk about more in a moment, I'm just going to throw this up here just to show you that it's possible to do a Merrill Lynch kind of analysis of all the investment options that you have out there, and to rank them based on some measure, rate of return to taxpayers in this case for Washington taxpayers. We can talk about these more in the other sessions this morning, but we've gone ahead and we've looked at early childhood programs, juvenile justice, adult programs, and prison as well, and we can come up with some conclusions. I want to wrap up now by saying here's the three things that we've suggested to our legislature from the work. Today in Washington, and I want to emphasize in Washington, incarcerating more violent and high-volume property offenders remains economically attractive. When we do that analysis, we find out that it's still a good idea to put more violent offenders in prison. Not get them out, you know, prosecute them, convict them, get them in prison. They'll still, returning taxpayers, a good return on their dollar. What we do find, though, is that the net benefits of incarcerating more drug offenders turn negative sometime in Washington in the 1990s. We've got too many drug offenders in prison. Where taxpayers are not getting a good return on their dollar. They're getting a return, but it's about 40 cents on the dollar that they spend for the average drug offender. So that's not a good investment. And what we've done is we found out that some research-based, underline that, I wish I could now, some research-based treatment programs can now provide better returns to Washington taxpayers than building new prison beds for certain kinds of offenders, like especially drug-involved offenders. Some kinds of drug treatment program works. And particularly in the juvenile justice system, you got to think big now. Don't think adult. That's one of you got to think like Starbucks. Where can we reduce crime? The juvenile justice system is a gold mine. There are some programs out there that work particularly well with juveniles, and those are where taxpayers can get some of their very best returns. Our legislature, as Dan said, has taken some of these actions in the last session and started to defund programs, actually cut some of the stuff that we're doing that we have evidence that don't work. It shifted those monies into the programs that do work, especially in the juvenile justice system. We're also starting to do that in the adult system. And we've changed some of the sentencing laws, taking some of those dollars savings and putting it back into drug treatment for certain kinds of offenders. So in closing, let me just say those are the things that work. Those are the three conclusions I give to my legislature. They'll be a little bit different for your state, especially regarding prison. And the reason that they'll be different from your state is because of what we already talked about, Prison Economics 101. That's where Washington is on that curve. I don't know where Wisconsin is on that curve, but those numbers can be fairly easily obtained. And you can find out where you are, and you can get those economics done. But in terms of at least Washington, there are some. The good news is that there are some ways that taxpayers can still lower the crime rate further and not have to fund the system anymore. In fact, actually take some of the savings to help fund our budget deficit as well by stopping to spend money on it. In other words, the good news is the Washington system is today inefficient. It's bad. We're spending money on things that don't work. Some things that don't work, some things do. And so if we can just stop spending it on those, every funding source has an interest group. But if you can do that, and our legislature has done it in the last two sessions, and move it into programs that work, we'll get lower crime and lower spending as well. Thanks very much, and I appreciate being here.
Okay, we're going to take a couple questions from Mr. Ose. I just want to point out that the many of these charts are in the briefing report, the table on what programs work and what don't is on page 27, the slide that he showed. Yes. Let's see, Russ. Okay. Do you have a question?
Yeah, thank you for your presentation. I want to do Economics 103 with you. Much of the investment here in Wisconsin, wise or not, has been in essentially longer sentences, which means that you have people who are in the older demographic groups essentially being imprisoned who with shorter sentences might be out. In doing your cost-benefit analysis and your correlation curve there, did you look at all at the question of longer sentences and when people who are, you know, even approaching the geriatric years are still in custody, whether that's beneficial or not? Did you break that out in your model?
No, we haven't done that work. The last legislature gave us an assignment that we're working on now to answer that question. In other words, we just tried to get these basic 101, 102 done for our state for the last session. The legislature said, gee, that's interesting. It asked that same question, and it gave us a new assignment to ask 103. So that's what we're working on right now. Yes.
Yeah. I don't know that this works. 85% of people in prisons came from homes where domestic violence was a factor. Okay, they, in other words, raised in a home where either there was an abusive parent, maybe there was alienation of one parent by the other parent, alienation of affection by one parent, you know, towards the children, in other words, the alienation syndrome. I don't know if Washington State is a no-fault state, but there have been some allegations by some social workers that no-fault brings about greater family violence in some situations. Now, I agree that juvenile programs may be our best focus of dollars. Is there a narrower focus that we could look at as a state based on juvenile programs that are available? In other words, should we focus on divorce and what happens in divorce court to get to the family violence? Do we just look at those juveniles that are the runaways and try and focus on those? Do we look at those that are involved in actual crime? Or is there a narrower spectrum within the juvenile justice program that we as a state could be looking at or that you've looked at that would help save us those dollars?
Ed may be able to answer that a little bit better. I don't know the research literature on domestic violence interventions and their effect on the crime rate or not. There may be a literature out there. I don't know that particular literature. Your broader question there on the juvenile justice, what we found is that you want to be like Starbucks again. You don't want to just say, oh, let's go into the coffee business. Oh, fun. You know, you want to say, how do we do it smart? And the way you do it smart is you pick out programs that already have a track record of working, the programs that you can call up on the phone and say, we'd like to do this program in Washington, and they can come in, they've got a manual. You don't want to reinvent the wheel, because what we have found in Washington is that when our agencies try to reinvent the wheel, those programs don't work. the agents people are probably, getting ready to shoot me now, but you've got to go out and get the programs that already have been, that have a theory. They know what Ed's going to talk about, that address some part of the crime, why people do crime. They address that specifically with very much rigor about who's doing the therapy and so on. And that's what you, and that's what our state has done. We've actually called up those people and we've brought them in. And so we're doing less develop your own program, which really doesn't work, and trying to bring in, sort of like the computer business a few years ago. People used to build their own computers and they didn't work that well. Well, now we find out it's better to let Dell build it and then you buy it and you get a great computer. And so why not do the same thing? Why make a market out of prevention programs? And that's what, it's a very important point to, that as you do the, if you decide to go the route of doing the blueprint what works programs, make sure that you don't just try to reinvent what you do, but actually go to the people that already know how to do it rather than reinvent it. It's cheaper and you get more results.